Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, bringing you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. In a COVID world, we have been focused on safety, yet almost all of us choose to engage in activities from swimming in the sea to driving a car or having a bottle of wine that carry risks. In fact, more died globally last year from alcohol than COVID. So how do we assess what risks to take and how much time and resource to protect ourselves from future risk? While it looks as if vaccines will bring the COVID pandemic under control, the next pandemic is potentially only just a virus away. Must we act urgently now to safeguard the world from a further catastrophe? Joining us to debate safety and risk, we have Beverly Taylor, Head of Influenza and Scientific Affairs at Seqirus, political commentator and freelance journalist Ella Whelan, and Emeritus Professor of Decision Sciences, Lawrence Phillips. This debate is in association with Seqirus. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice and visit iii.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos, and articles from the world's leading thinkers. I'll now hand you over to our host for this debate, Marianne Seagart.
So how do we assess what risks to take and how much time and resource to protect ourselves from future risk? While it looks as if vaccines will bring the COVID pandemic under control, the next pandemic is potentially just a virus away. Must we act urgently now to safeguard the world further from a future catastrophe? Or should we assess this against other global risks and then the cost and the resource involved? Is our ultimate goal to eradicate risk? Or must we just accept that risk is unavoidable? Well, we've got a great panel to discuss this here. Beverly Taylor is a biochemist. She's Head of Influenza and Scientific Affairs at Seqirus and is an expert on global vaccine production and the inner workings of the WHO. Ella Whelan is a political commentator and freelance journalist. Her criticism of no platforming and 21st century feminism has caused her to clash with mainstream journalists on the BBC, Sky and Channel 4. And her first book is What Women Want, Fun, Freedom and an End to Feminism. Lawrence Phillips, who likes to be called Larry, is an Emeritus Professor of Decision Sciences at the London School of Economics and a Director of Facilitations Limited. After a career beginning in electrical engineering and 3 years in the US Navy, Larry has become a leading expert in decision science with decades of experience studying risk. So, as you all know, the formula is that each of our guests here has 3 minutes to do a pitch on the first question, which is, in the context of the pandemic, how do we assess what risks to take and how much time and resource to protect ourselves from future risk? Beverly, I'm going to start with you.
Okay, thank you. As we all know, we've just come through a devastating pandemic, which isn't quite over yet, had huge impact on the economy as well as public health and social health. And, you know, I do believe that we've got to be prepared for that. I think we need to be prepared. I think we need robust surveillance of what viruses are emerging. And I think we need robust health systems for everybody so that all the preparedness activities can be implemented. I don't want to leave people with the impression that there is no preparedness, because WHO actually works to carry out surveillance globally to look for emerging viruses. And this is an ongoing program. I work on influenza, and there are 155 labs worldwide in 125 different countries that year-round, day after day, are carrying out surveillance for influenza viruses. Not only the seasonal viruses, but the emerging viruses. And those emerging viruses coming from that can potentially cause a pandemic come from the animal-human interface. So the surveillance at that interface is a real opportunity for us to pick something up really early so that we can start building the preparedness in. And governments are also being prepared. So if you look at the UK government, we have like a risk register for the UK, and influenza is right up there at the top, as it is in many other countries. And the UK government has got preparedness plans. The problem is they were really focused on a pandemic influenza and not for COVID-19. So we've had a contract with the UK since 2012 to supply vaccines if it was influenza. And we've got contracts with other countries. So this is something that has been thought about. And a lot of the things that were put in place that people won't be aware of at all, but actually got used for the COVID response. So the WHO preparation, the whole system, the whole network that they've got for influenza was actually used to carry out surveillance for COVID-19. So that's how we know that the new variants are coming out. That's how we can develop new diagnostic kits, work on second generation vaccines. The same in the UK, you know, the robust supply chains, the stockpiles of vials and syringes, and the fact that we have a vaccine that we make every year means that in the case of influenza, we could just have switched that over and made a vaccine much more quickly than we could for COVID, because we already do that every year. Unfortunately, in this case, it happened to be COVID and not influenza, but still that preparedness made a difference. And I think we have to keep thinking about that. So important to be prepared for whatever comes our way. But if it's a respiratory virus or something else, a lot of the preparedness plans that we have already in place for influenza could be utilised for a pandemic response.
Okay, that's interesting. I'm sure we'll come back to that. Ella?
I think that there's practical questions about how you prepare to prevent against the negative ways in which risk can affect you. And Beverly, completely agree with everything you've just said in relation to making sure there is the materials there for us to prepare for a future pandemic. But I suppose what I might put forward is the question of politically how we deal with risk. And I really think that you should flip the question on its head, that the balance for too long has been too far swayed in favour of preventing against risk rather than thinking about what we need to do to manoeuvre towards a life and a politics of greater freedom. And this balance between safety and being concerned with risk and freedom has been very much tilted one way throughout the pandemic. Obviously, in the early stages of the pandemic and when the virus was at its worst, for very good reasons, and doing preventative things like lockdown measures to help protect NHS from being overrun, or indeed protect the elderly from dying, as many of them did, was a beneficial balancing of that risk versus freedom sort of swaying. But I think that risk prevention, as we come out of the pandemic, we really have to think about the way in which we have pathologized risk. We now consider risk to be an insurmountable challenge, something that we must almost in all ways prevent against. I mean, I know that there's a war going on, a bit of a kind of culture war going on about vaccine passports across Europe, but particularly in the UK, you know, the government flip-flopping on whether or not they're going to have it. That being a very good example of where the idea of risk overcomes and the prevention of risk overcomes the need to think about civil liberties and freedom. But I think the crucial thing to think about, and we're considering how important the idea of risk is, or maybe the beneficial parts of risk, is to understand that this phenomenon of us dealing with risk as a kind of an evil, something to be warded off, hasn't just fallen from the sky during the pandemic. It's actually come out of political trends that have been long in the making. So they, you know, from sort of banal things, if you want to think of it in a banal way, like anti-smoking laws or interventions in relation to public health, being about pathologizing risk at the expense of individual freedom, there's been that trend. On a more political level, throughout the pandemic, the government has implemented bans on protest, bans on freedom of speech online, and the way in which coronavirus or vaccines or whatever can be talked about. And that has happened for decades previously through bans on freedom of speech and freedom of debate. I mean, the current police crime prevention bill that's pretty much Priti Patel cracking down on protests, is all part of that sense of risk involves trusting people to make decisions. And what we really are saying in society is that we can't trust people to make decisions. There's the kind of practical aversion to risk, you know, that we should police what people eat in case there's the risk that if they're allowed to eat what they want, they become a drain on the NHS and are obese and fat. There's a psychological aversion to risk. You know, we often talk about, particularly in education, the risk of marking kids' work with a red pen or telling them that they're wrong or disciplining them in case it causes some kind of psychological harm along the way. And then, as I've already mentioned, there's the political risk. I mean, I was just on a panel yesterday about dissent and democracy. One of the biggest problems we have in contemporary politics is a misbelief in trusting people to take risks when it comes to political opinions, to try out discussions, to try out ideas in free debates. What we want to do is flip risk on its head and think sensibly about it and think that one of, you know, what Beverly mentions, one of the most amazing things to come out of this pandemic has been the vaccine. And I'm no epidemiologist or scientist and know anything like that. I know a little bit from being a St. John's Ambulance volunteer vaccinator, a tiny bit. But the, you know, the whole exciting thing about that is that taking risks and innovating in the world of science, for example, is part of progress. You can't experiment, you can't make mistakes, you can't learn lessons unless you inherently embrace the positives of risk. So I think we should think about what shunning risk and embracing safety in expense of freedom leaves us in terms of political change and progress in society.
Thanks very much. Larry.
Well, I have a problem about all this because you're talking about taking risks. Actually, you don't take risks. I don't set out to take risks. What I do is I make decisions, and you said that, Ella. We take decisions, not risks. Risks are a consequence. What choices did I make in the light of COVID? Well, when we take decisions because we want to make something better. We have a goal, an objective. And my objective, my fundamental objective, is to stay alive. So I have another objective, and that's to help other people. As a decision analyst, I do a lot of that. So I decided, yes, I would get vaccinated, right? So I've helped myself to stay alive, and I've helped you to stay alive as well. I don't see that there can be any doubt about that, but obviously there is in some people's minds, and that may be because they have different objectives. So I think we have to look at the objectives of what it is we're trying to do. And you talked about political objectives and other objectives. Yes, they're all these. But fundamentally, what do? We take decisions. Let me tell you a little short story. My father smoked most of his life. When he was 70 years old, my sister, who was a nurse, took him through the emphysema ward of the local hospital. And as he left, he turned to her and said, "Oh my God, there are better and worse ways to die." He quit smoking immediately and lived to be 96.
Oh, brilliant.
So he had another objective, which was the quality of his life. And we take decisions to do those things. We don't take risks. We accept risk amounts. But let's focus on what we should be doing and what the objectives are that we are looking at.
Okay, so we're going to start by discussing, should rationality drive our decisions about risk? It's an odd question because obviously we don't want to be irrational in our decisions about risk. But I think probably Ella touched on how we can expand this, which is, you know, a lot of people just say, well, listen to the scientists and do whatever the scientists say. But actually, there is a much more of a political decision to be taken about what our risk appetite is. So Ella, I'd like you to talk about this, but also could you also, because you didn't really do this in your introduction, talk about the difference between people having a high risk appetite for themselves and saying, no, I don't want to have a vaccine, I'm prepared to take the risk of catching COVID and I think I'll be fine, but also the fact that if they don't have a vaccine, they're more likely to give it to other people.
Yeah, I mean, it's as someone who's very, very pro vaccine. In fact, if there's a jab, give it to me. I'm not too fussy about it. I get the flu jab every year and all that kind of thing. It's very hard to inhabit the psyche of someone who is, I would argue, perhaps irrationally against the vaccine, who will refuse to, you know, whether it's kind of like, to use stereotypes, hippies in Bristol or people who listen to David Icke in Trafalgar Square. It's very hard to inhabit their way of thinking. But part of when we're talking about the practical aspect of needing to vaccinate a population for a social prevention of a very real risk of coronavirus killing people, What we're also talking about in that social responsibility is the what are the risks of limiting and condemning and restricting people having free opinions. That's the other side of the risk, is what happens when you mandate something and what are the ramifications of the risk that will come with that. So it's a, you know, I'm really glad you mentioned the whole thing of, you know, just rely on the science, which actually is becoming a trend, not just in relation to COVID, but in relation to climate change, in relation to, you know, to bring up that word that everyone hates to hear at How the Light Gets In Festival, in Brexit during the 2016 referendum. The whole idea of just listen to the experts, don't take risks with the economy or anything. There is this trend to depoliticize issues. And part of the point of risk and our quality of life, our objectives of how we live, because human beings aren't just about staying alive, otherwise we'd be no better than animals, is thinking about what risks are good, what risks are bad, and what risks are worth it. You know, so on balance, I would always argue that the risk of you taking the vaccine, whatever you conceive that to be, is not worth it to put at risk the other lives of the rest of your citizens. That's quite a sophisticated thing that we have to try and get people to come along with. The crucial thing is talking about it, having an argument about it, rather than saying, because there's a risk, there's no discussion here. That's the difference between having a very kind of, you know, talking about rationality, having a sort of evidence-based, very apolitical, very kind of limiting scientific way of looking at risk, and saying that actually it's part of human nature to take risks. It's part of politics of democracy to consider risk.
Beverly, you're the scientist.
Yes, I was just going to say, so I'm the scientist. Obviously, I'm going to fall down on the rational side of the fence. And I think there is a lot of value in, you know, evaluating all the data, identifying what criteria you're going to use to make decisions. It's not going to be perfect, but at least it gives you a starting point for decision making. I think as well that it's really important that people are informed completely. So I'm just going to give an example here. So when all the issue about the AstraZeneca vaccine causing blood clots came out, you know, the number of blood clots were 4 per million people. Women on the contraceptive pill, between 500 and 1200 women get blood clots per million. If you smoke, it's 1800 blood clots per million. But wait for the punchline, because if you get COVID, 165,000 cases per million of blood clots. Why did we just hear in the media there are 4 blood clots per million people? Don't you think that people deserve to have the full picture so they can make, it might not be a completely rational decision. There is a book written by Kahneman, which is actually in the bookstore here, talking about fast and slow thinking. And I think the slow thinking is the rational process that we go through, but you do need some facts as the baseline for that. And then if you make a gut feel decision at the end of that, at least it's based on something. But I think giving people half the story is misleading. It's just causing concern for people. And, you know, I just think, you know, you need to look at the facts.
And do you feel that the media weren't presenting enough facts?
Well,
pandemic?
I think they tried very hard. I am not judging the media. You need to give the complete picture so that people can make a more of an informed decision. You know, I don't know if people knew the difference in the risk of blood clots between having the vaccine.
Politicians didn't either.
No,
I mean,
no.
Half European politicians took the decision out of our hands by blocking it in Germany and France.
Right? And the other thing I just want to add is, you know, sometimes you do something not just for yourself, but for other people. And if you look in the case of influenza, there was a decision made to immunize children for influenza, and they started this pediatric program, and the kids get the nasal flu in the school program. My son goes through it. And demonstrated that the hospitalizations in the elderly every season have gone down because we've managed to control the disease in these, you know, snotty children that love to hug everybody and mix together and everything, and it's made a difference. You know, so sometimes it's not obvious, you know, if we immunize the kids, we'll get this result, but that's the result.
Larry?
Oh, goodness. We talk about rationality. We talk about risk. To my mind, being rational is being consistent in making decisions that realize your objectives. okay? I think most of us would agree with that. But we haven't really talked about what we mean by risk. And this is where I begin to worry about following the science. And this is because risk, according to Paul Slovak, who's a social scientist, a friend of mine, who published a paper many years ago in Science magazine, he actually asked people to compare risks. Now, if risk is a single thing, like the probability of something bad happening, which most of us think about it, then if A is riskier than B, and B is riskier than C, then A must be riskier than C. Well, it doesn't take very much experimentation to discover, no, sometimes C is seen to be riskier than A. So how many dimensions do you have to have in order...
How does that work? If A is riskier than B and B is riskier than C...
Then A must be riskier than C.
How can that not be the case? You're saying sometimes it isn't.
It definitely isn't, because he asked all these comparisons of people and sometimes they said C was riskier than A.
Oh, I see. So people's assessment of risk is...
So they're going around in circles, and that's irrational.
Yeah.
We all would agree with that. So the question is, how many dimensions of risk do you need in order to explain what it is? And he found three. The first one was the extent to which you dread the consequences, right? That's an internal feeling. Would you dread living next to a nuclear power station? Probably. The other one, other dimension, is the extent to which the risk is unknown. Well, actually, at the beginning, we didn't know very much about COVID. And we dreaded it because it looked like it was pretty dangerous. And the third dimension is how many people are affected. That's at least an objective one, and we can measure that one. But basically, you've got two subjective concepts. So when scientists say the probability is low for whatever, as they did, remember, when BSE was around?
Yeah.
I used to say to my students, explain BSE response on these three dimensions. Well, on the dread dimension, I dread my brain turning into a sponge. On the vertical dimension, we didn't know anything about it. And who is affected? Just everybody who's been eating beef. Right? So no wonder people thought that it was risky to eat beef. Even though the scientists, you know, what was it? One of them fed his daughter a hamburger or something.
Yeah, John Gummins, yes. Yes.
Well, we need to focus on the dimensions of risk that people are worried about. Now, the press, to my mind, is irresponsible in reporting how many people died. You always got to say what the proportion is. Yes, it's got to, but better, not a, we don't understand proportions. It's better to say how many out of 100,000 or 10,000, right? So that would be a better way. We're still seeing graphs of just how many people have died, and that's not as informative for taking decisions as knowing what the risk is. Anyway, we need to think about things to reduce the sense of dread, which, of course, the media can easily inflate, and just be more rational by thinking about how people are thinking about risk. Not that it's the probability of something bad happening. That doesn't help.
Okay. Let's move on now to, you know, we're encouraged to get flu jabs, aren't we? Particularly over 50s. But there's nothing like the focus on flu jabs as there is on COVID jabs. Presumably that's because COVID is a lot more serious in its consequences than flu, is it?
Well, obviously COVID has caused a global pandemic, which we're not in a global pandemic for influenza right now. So, you know, I think obviously the focus has been on that. And, you know, we didn't know at the beginning. And so there's been this real drive to get people vaccinated. But actually, we do pretty well for flu in certain age groups in the UK. So for the over 65s, you know, there's a WHO target for these risk groups, for 70% of people in the risk groups to get vaccinated. And we're usually almost at that in the UK. And last year, we actually exceeded that for the over 65s. And, you know, that's been through years of encouraging people to do that, not mandating it. But that helped tremendously because that cohort of people that needed to have the COVID vaccine early on, the over 65s, are already used to going for their annual flu vaccine. So there was no very little vaccine hesitancy from some of those groups. Now it's different in some of the younger groups because I think that they perceive risk in a totally different way. They don't feel so much at risk themselves. But I do think that the things that were in place for influenza, I mean, if we were in a pandemic influenza, you know, so if you look at some of the pandemic strains, so there's, you may have heard of the bird flu, H5N1. There was another strain, H7N9, which caused quite, thousands of cases in China from 2013 to 2017. If you look at the mortality rate for those strains, they're between 30% and 50%, much higher than COVID. So, you know, you can't say never for influenza, but I think, you know, for seasonal influenza, I think we should encourage as much as possible and demonstrate the benefits, but it would be a different situation if we were in an influenza pandemic.
But for seasonal flu, we go and get our jabs because we don't want to catch it. There isn't that sense of we get a jab to protect other people, is there?
Yeah, I know, and I think that there should be, because it was interesting, before I was coming on here to do the panel, I decided in a severe season for influenza in the UK, we can see up to 30,000 deaths. So I don't expect anybody to have known that. And, you know, and maybe we should. So then I took the 30,000 and I thought, right, you know, flu season over the winter months. So I generously gave it 6 months. And I divided the 30,000 by the number of the days in 6 months. And that's 165 deaths a day from influenza in a severe season. Well, that is not dissimilar to the numbers that we're seeing for COVID. Okay, it's been sort of for a longer period, not just over the winter months. But that again gives you another dimension on the risk. You know, I don't think people appreciate the risk from influenza because we never see the numbers in the media.
Yeah, but 30,000 over the winter season, if you looked at COVID deaths over the winter season, it would be quite a bit more than that, wouldn't it?
It depends, because we don't know. I mean, people weren't vaccinated last winter. I mean, some of the numbers were high. So if maybe this winter will be a better...
We'll find out.
...better comparison. Yeah. But influenza is not without risk, and the numbers... We don't have a severe season every season, but, when we do, it's right up there.
And if you, I mean, it's hard not to, when you give us a figure like 165 deaths a day, or and the rolling news figures of deaths have really ramped up a sense of fear in society, and that the media is very responsible for scaring the shit out of people, you know, in some ways, very necessarily to hammer home the reality of the challenge that we were faced with coronavirus. But also in other respects, to allow the government to get away with some of its more lazy and reprehensible policies. So if you look at the ongoing policy of restricting care home visits, for example, this is really practical, the issue of elderly people not just elderly people, any resident of a care home, because there are people in care homes of all ages. They have been, while the rest of us are here enjoying the sunshine together in a tent, maskless and, you know, relatively in small steps going back to normal life, in care homes, people, for example, elderly people with dementia, were still having restrictions on them being allowed out of that home, of them being allowed to touch their friends and family without PPE. Really inhumane things that in the middle of an emergency virus, you think, okay, to protect life, in some instances, might be justifiable, but now really is unjustifiable. And you have some politicians and commentators coming forward and saying, in order to protect against flu, and the way in which, you know, flu can be deadly for particularly the elderly and the infirm, we should continue these restrictions. And what lots of people in care homes and their family and friends are saying, well, what's the balance here? If my mother is in a care home and she is going in and she has dementia, and most people who have known people with dementia know that there's a limited time in which you get, they usually go in and it's about 6 or 7 years and then they end up tragically dying. That's generally the trajectory of people with dementia. I know I used to work in a care home. That what's the cost of being unable to interact with that person and enjoy that last year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, and then protecting them and shielding them and treating them in this very inhumane way? There's a real loss of sense of balance. And so while, you know, what frustrates me most is that one of the things that the government has done well is the vaccine rollout. And rather than celebrate the innovation of human beings to come up with and fantastic scientists to come up with a way to deal, to allow us to be able to take risks again, to be able to look at each other without masks, to be able to hold hands, to be able for their to kids to kiss their grandkids. Rather than celebrate that, what we can, the narrative continues to be, how do we stay away from risk? Should we now moving into the winter have another lockdown? Should we now moving into the winter make masks mandatory, make vaccine passports mandatory, despite the fact that the Delta variant, as I in my limited understanding, throws vaccine passports all into question and its effectiveness? There's a lack of emphasis on how to, this is what I'm kind of hammering home, the move towards freedom, rather than an obsession with risk. And the flu really terrifies me because particularly, not just because of its danger, but because for old people, that to lots of them sounds like another death knell on their freedom, because you can see the argument for keeping people locked up and shielded in case they catch flu or come into contact with flu. When actually lots of elderly people throughout the pandemic were saying, I'm not going to stop seeing my grandkids. I've probably got, you know, an hour or another year in this world. I want to live it the way I live it. And respecting that sense of being objective about quality of life is important as well.
Mm. I think those are very good points about care homes. But actually, when it comes to freedom, we've got one of the highest number of cases per million of COVID at the moment in the world. And yet we're actually really quite free compared with other countries. You know, I've had friends coming over here from France, from Ireland, from America saying, God, it's so weird people aren't wearing masks here, you know, where I've been living. Yeah. Or even Scotland, yeah, where I've been living. Well, we are sort of outdoors, aren't we? but nonetheless, I mean, actually, wouldn't you say that this government's got really quite a high appetite for risk compared with other countries?
It depends. I think that if you look at the way in which, if you look at, for example, what France is doing, or what it was doing in relation to needing a mandatory vaccines for, you know, going into a library, a cafe, going about normal life rather than sort of targeted. For example, I'm probably in favour of vaccine passports, though it makes me uncomfortable for specific areas like care homes, because there's in taking into account all the risks and all the balances, I think it's probably necessary in very limited, you know, places like that. But when France, along with Merkel and Macron, having kind of thrown massive doubt on the population about the effectiveness of vaccines and AstraZeneca and playing fast and loose with the truth, now suddenly cracks down on a population, and the population is much less likely, actually, to want to get that vaccine and understand the necessity of getting that vaccine, because A, they've been misinformed quite literally, and B, there's a sense of coercion, which isn't treating citizens seriously. But it's not rosy in the UK. The picture is not rosy. Because while we've had greater take-up of vaccine, that's a real thing to celebrate, a more positive response to taking lockdown measures seriously, and actually we have on the whole had quite a compliant population who have stayed at home, who have volunteered, who have done the things they need to do on the whole. The government's response is to continue to dangle risk over us as a threat. So you have Nadine Zahawi, back in January, saying, no way in hell will I have vaccine passports. We will never be a papers, please society. We understand how dangerous that would be with civil liberties. A few months later, it's like, did I say that? So the UK government is incredibly duplicitous in terms of being able to take citizens seriously and trust us to be able to manage risk. So, you know, whether it be continuation of emergency COVID laws, the continuation of crackdowns on protests, I know that how the light gets in festival in relation to its size and capacity has had to change, despite the fact that it's an outdoor festival and everybody here is incredibly sensible and safe. You know, the effect of all these measures on the normal goings on of life, even myself, I'm planning the Battle of Ideas Festival that's taking place in 3 weeks, and I'm constantly having sleepless nights as to whether or not Boris Johnson's going to decide to flip-flop on putting in some kind of restrictions and just I'll have to bin all my work. And the dangling of risk as a threat, I think, is what the government is now doing, rather than embracing not the new normal, but some kind of normality that is free from the threat of restriction.
What do you think about that, Larry?
Well, again, it all depends about what the risk is about. We're talking about health risks, and in general, the research shows that we are conservative about health risks. But that's not true of social risks, not true necessarily of financial risks, of recreational risks, gambling, and so forth. In other words, it depends upon what it is we're talking about, and we focused mainly on health risks. And the interesting thing is that when people get together and talk about risk, they can actually change their risk attitude. And in general, what happens is that when they talk about all those other things other than health risks, they become more risky. But in health, when we talk about it, they get less risky. So I have no idea whether this will have that impact on all of you. You'll go away, especially after what Bev has said in comparing COVID to flu, you know, thinking carefully about this, you might actually change your attitude.
Well, actually, that leads very well into our third question, which is, should our experience of the pandemic change our attitude to risk in the future? I mean, you're suggesting it probably will.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it.
I think we'll become more conservative. More of us will walk around with face masks on routinely in the winter.
Well, it depends upon how we communicate. If we fearmonger by not paying attention to those three dimensions, and we keep saying, no, it's safe, then that's not the right approach either.
Well, fearmongering is saying it's dangerous, isn't it?
Well, We all know that COVID is something bad. If you only report the bad stuff about COVID, you will make people even more worried about it. That's what I'm saying.
But should we be more worried? You're saying we shouldn't, are you?
Well, I've never used the word should, because should is my judgment about what you're doing.
Yeah.
And I don't know what your objectives are, so I don't say should about anything. It's hard, by the way, to not do it.
It is. Actually, it's very hard.
but the point is that we need to know how are people taking decisions? On what basis are they taking decisions? And over time, we do change. And we can change that Paul Slovic also has done studies about how fear can sort of socially permeate everybody's. People who are afraid to fly very often have thought, oh my God, this is terrible. We just get stories about how many people were killed and they don't want to fly. Well, yeah, because we don't hear about all those days when it was perfectly safe. So there's a social spread of risk, which is not rational. And we got to keep that in balance.
Beverly, you're the scientist. Do you think that our experience of this pandemic should change our attitude to risk?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has. I mean, we've been doing a piece of work with a professor from a university in Norway, and he's looked in several European countries, including the UK, about the perception of vaccination. And actually, because we've been through this massive COVID vaccination program, here in the UK, people are more likely to get influenza vaccine, which is really interesting. So I think the value of vaccination has really come through. I mean, it's been seen as a saviour. I mean, Sarah Gilbert gets a standing ovation at Wimbledon, which is absolutely amazing and well-deserved. So, you know, I think perceptions have already changed. You know, I think as well, from a planning perspective, they've also got to change because, you know, we have to be ready for the next pandemic, you know. I've worked in flu for over 20 years, and everybody knows that a flu pandemic will occur. If you look, you know, we had 2018, we had the Spanish flu, 57, we had Asian flu, 68.
What did 1918.
Oh, sorry, 1918, yeah. sorry.
Yeah,
And 1968, we had the Hong Kong flu, and then in 2009, obviously, we had the swine flu. You know, there is a certain cadence to the influenza pandemics, and we can't say when it will happen, but you know, in the field of influenza, people say we know it will happen, it's just when it will happen. So I think some of the plans, you know, we need to take the learnings from COVID, you know, what worked well, what was already there, but what didn't work well, and how could we make it better. I think we have to think about preparedness as an insurance. You know, we've all got house insurance, but we don't expect our house to burn down or whatever. But the insurance is there. It gives us peace of mind. And I think we've got to stop looking at preparedness as a cost and more preparedness as insurance. I've worked on pandemic preparedness for influenza for many years. And even talking to my colleagues at work, a pandemic was such an abstract concept, and I'd be saying, well, you know, we need to make sure our supply chain's robust, you know, we need to look at having more stocks of vials and things like this. And as we were building this program, because it wasn't happening tomorrow, people were like, oh, well, we've got plenty of time. And then all of a sudden the pandemic hit, and it was like, where did that report go that Beverly wrote about pandemic preparedness? You know, and I said, oh, I just happened to have a copy here. Oh, you're listening now. You know, but it's completely changed because it's happened, and people all of a sudden say, oh, my God, it can happen.
So next time round, you're saying we will be better prepared?
Well, I hope we have the opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, because the risk of us having an influenza that is more severe than COVID is very, very real. And, you know, but we do have the opportunity, and I am an optimist, and I think we can take the lessons, we can build something better so that we will be better prepared for next time, and we can save more lives.
But from your experience, you know, WHO and presumably here, do you think the political will is now there for more preparedness, for spending money on something that isn't a problem now, but might be in the future?
I do, yeah. But I also remember how short the memories were in 2009 after swine flu.
That's right.
So yeah. Swine flu wasn't as severe as COVID, but memories, particularly political memories, don't last that long. So I think we've got to strike while the iron's hot and try and get some things embedded so that they carry on. And I'm not just talking about in the UK or in developed countries. We really need to look at low and middle income countries.
You know, the swine flu reminds me, I was working at the European Medicines Agency at the time, and Thomas Longgren said, we have a real problem. This was in August 2009. The WHO has just declared this H1N1 virus, it's pandemic now. What shall we do? We have a big problem in this in the EMA because we can't approve the drug. We don't have enough data. But on the other hand, if we wait to approve it, people will die. So what do we do? We had to do a decision analysis, and the first person to speak said, you don't want to do this because we don't have the data. And we did have the data because we drew on past experiences. So we did formulate probabilities, put the thing together, and it said you should act now. And actually the CHMP and the EMA did act right away in September rather than wait until October. The lesson from that is the preparedness has to recognize how important it is to move quickly.
I think it would be, you know, the funny thing is, despite the fact that we've had daily reminders of the death toll of coronavirus, and that has obviously, the loss of life is the most serious effect of COVID, if you're thinking about it in the abstract. When you talk to people about the last 18, 19 months, and when you have conversations, you say, usually people say, hasn't the pandemic been awful, the way in which we haven't been able to see each other. The thing that they think of as first and foremost as the worst part of this experience has been the social isolation, the stoppage of society. You don't necessarily talk about the fact of how many people died. And I think what that shows you is that if we are to learn something, and if we are to do something differently in the way in which we respond to future challenges, is that I think we've learned what the cost and consequences of being of preventing risk has been. And the other side of that, the flip side of what is the cost of organizing society around the potential for risk. And if you to give a different example other than coronavirus, and to sort of give an example, despite with the greatest respect to scientists on the panel, why it's sometimes difficult to allow people who are experts in their field, whether it be science or the economy or something, to make decisions, is that you tend to have a relatively blinkered view of, if you're constantly looking at death toll figures and the potential risk, it's hard to broaden out and think about what the consequences of mitigating against those risks are. So that in a WHO sort of draft paper that was released, there was the suggestion that all women of childbearing age, which means, you know, women who've had girls who've had a period, so we're talking about like what, 13, 14 onwards, should abstain from alcohol in case they became pregnant. And this was in relation to levels of fetal alcohol syndrome. That is absolutely bananas that you would suggest for women's liberation that women should never touch a drop of alcohol in case they might fall pregnant at some point. And that's, you know, that's an absurd example, but I think that if we're to move forward with how to appreciate freedom, we have to stop prioritising risk as the be-all and end-all thing to deal with and actually flip it and say, what are the consequences and what are the benefits of embracing risk and embracing the potential for danger in some forms?
Okay, fantastic. So it just remains for me to say thank you so much to Ella, Larry, Beverly. It's been a fascinating debate.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Philosophy for Our Times. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe on your platform of choice and visit ii.tv for hundreds more podcasts, videos and articles from the world's leading thinkers.